My name is Michael McCusker. Before I do anything, I'd like to wish Astoria a happy 202nd birthday tomorrow, April 12th. And don't forget that Wednesday, of course, is King MUN's 30th birthday, the 17th of April. Well, this morning I'm going to speak of two rather poisonous subjects, taxes and pesticides. I've written both of these articles, so I should probably give the disclaimer that they are my opinion, and perhaps my opinion only in the entire cosmos and parallel universes. And they are updated from a couple of articles I've read in the past, especially the one on pesticides. It seems to be an annual. But it reminds me of what a drill instructor used to tell me back in Marine Corps boot camp, that first I'm going to tell you what I'm going to tell you, then I'm going to tell you, and then I'm going to tell you what I told you. These things don't go away, and we just keep getting hit on the head by the fact that they're still with us and we still got to do things about them. And I will begin with the tax wars, with a quote from Exxon Cervenka, lead singer of the punk band X, if even that's still in existence. I have killed more people than Unabomber Ted Kaczynski because I have been paying a lot of taxes the past 15 years, and he hasn't. The tax wars. American history boiled to the bone might be encapsulated as war and money rather than about rights, liberties, and equality. And the reduction might be further compressed if it is argued that the wars have all been fought for money, which would reconfigure the pursuit of wealth as the total fabric of the USA's manifest destiny. This perspective of history is obviously an injustice to those who have struggled and often been jailed, bled, or died for the larger beliefs relevant in the Bill of Rights. Yet the very fact of the intensity of the strife for equity and justice within our own Constitution gives legitimacy to the claim that for the powerful elite, money is the only mainspring of the nation's history. If indeed this narrow view of history has any credence, it must be realized that a select few have from the very beginning profited from the collective effort of the many. In this context, the term freedom is misapplied, both politically and economically. Free enterprise, and that's a quote, is a misnomer for the fact that throughout the country's 237-year history, from 1776, the wealthiest Americans have for the most part accumulated and maintained their wealth at government expense, essentially through sales and subsidies, and most recently gigantic bailouts of the financial sector that has nearly bankrupted the nation, as well as much of the world, which can also be defined as the blood and taxes of the majority who generally make possible but seldom share in the abundance. Newt Gingrich used to say, "The engine that pulls the train must be refueled." By that he meant the new Tories of wealth and business should not share tax obligations with the common folk. Affluent taxpayers must receive breaks because they invest money and create jobs for others, Newt explained disingenuously, as if it had not been said before. In reality, those affluent taxpayers rarely invest in anything except their own stock portfolios, and they not only do not pay their fair share of taxes, they gorge on public money, which people like Gingrich and former President G.W. Bush call welfare when it is distributed among the poor and investment when extorted by the rich. At the same time our political lords cut off welfare to single mothers and downsize workers, they initiate special tax breaks to favored corporations that amount to billions of dollars. They cut the taxes of big business, which invests a portion into the welfare of favored politicians, and the rich, who are shareholders in most of these same corporations, and spoil them with billions more in subsidies they claim are essential to the free market, which is regarded as a natural force. Public services and poverty programs are gutted to make up for the shortfall. The rich get richer, and the poor get poorer, because the poor subsidize the rich. That is national tax policy. Corporations are, after all, inherently socialist rather than capitalist. Big business does not compete for sheer love of competition in an unfettered emporium of commerce, which is the myth of capitalism. The almighty free market is, in truth, the savage battleground to dominate the American economy in the bitter, ruthless goal of winner-take-all. The neo-Tories quote Jefferson, twist him into a laissez-faire philosopher. Gingrich again. When Jefferson said every generation needs a revolution, he wasn't making an argument for chaos. He was making an argument for the creative replacement of the old order with a new order. But old Tom's intent was to replace a repressive and corrupt colonial government with a truly revolutionary guarantee of power to the people. The new Tories' purpose is to return the USA to the vertically organized and patronage-dominated 18th century that the American and French revolutions blew asunder. Attempting to reestablish an old order of privilege and power based on wealth and property in this new millennium runs counter to Thomas Paine's vision of a decent and happy life for ordinary Americans who are assumed to be rulers rather than ruled. The plutocrats who control the major corporations claim the economy defines the nation more than its ideology. Money, they say, is the nation's ideology. What they mean by their strict definition of the economy is their own personal domination of the national wealth. In theory, everybody has an equal chance to make a buck and live the American dream, but of course some are more equal than others. Narrow monetary policies that singularly benefit the upper layers of society draw money from less well-off levels, which keeps them less well-off and always under pressure to pay what is demanded. Releasing public money, most of it pried from middle class and blue-collar labor, to business and the wealthy elite is considered sound investment and essential to the economy. Providing public funds to the poor is regarded as uneconomical and a severe drain on the national treasury. Corporate culture is conditioned by commercial and public falsehoods that coerce the people to buy and pledge allegiance to America Incorporated, which transforms the American public from a democratic citizenry responsible for its rights, liberties, and pursuit of justice and equality to pre-adolescently avaricious consumers for whom only money and material possessions count. Ralph Nader says that a civic culture has been swarmed over by a corporate culture. The pattern of corporate dominance is as true for the USA today as it was for the Nazis and fascists early in the 20th century. Wage slashes and huge government subsidies and tax cuts for the already affluent. The Nazis and fascists maintained their grip on power by enriching their industrial patrons while tyrannizing the populaces of their nations. Corporations receive rebates on taxes they never paid and resent government intrusion, and that's a quote, into their affairs, criticizing regulations regarding their methods of business. However, they do not think government tax breaks or subsidies should be curtailed, and certainly not huge bailouts of tax money when their financial policies drive them and most of the rest of the country into insolvency. The rupture between corporate profit and national economic growth is seen in the dependence of the private sector's profits in looting the public treasury, pillaging the natural environment, and reducing social services instead of developing new technology and enlarging markets through expansion of goods and services. Billions of dollars are appropriated from important areas like healthcare and housing. The private plunder of the public domain extends to natural resources. Land, seabeds, and timber are stripped or despoiled without regard for long-term consequences. Laying off millions of workers from employment, as well as shipping jobs overseas, necessitates huge welfare costs, which the wealthy, who eliminate the jobs, are not paying, leaving it up to already overburdened middle and working-class taxpayers to pay. The U.S. gloats in its reigning superpower status and acts in the old Roman way, inflicting its immense capacity for war upon the world, which is its main offering to the New World Order. But it is a defective colossus, Its economy has come undone, the imperial fabric tearing apart due to its own internal rapacity and the hundreds of trillions of dollars of public money wasted on the military at the expense of its own internal civic disintegration in the holy names of defense, national security, and now this new war on terrorism, which must be paid for. Taxes will be raised from the humble and underfed. More money will be looted from already prostrate social programs, and heavy borrowing from other more cash-fattened nations will probably be essential to prop up and replenish our hugely expensive military machine. And there are very few of those anymore, cash-fattened nations. The domestic decline of the United States is primarily the responsibility of the armed might that has bestowed its celebrated victories. The military-industrial complex that one of its most fortunate and celebrated benefactors, President Dwight D. Eisenhower, warned the nation about when he left office 4 decades ago. This gigantic interlocking mafia of corporations and the military machine they built, as well as congressional acquiescence, which is the third leg of the triad, fashioned an American overseas empire. The nation was itself created and forged by war and an insatiable appetite for military power. War is the ultimate form of economic competition, Brooks Adams wrote at the beginning of America's reach for global supremacy. And by the way, I made an error there. It's been 5 decades now since Eisenhower left the presidency. Even if we eventually surface from the economic disaster brought on by Wall Street and its casino banks, the Pentagon's bloated budget has soared to a huge black hole into which everything is eventually drawn and disappears, such as the nation's wealth and resources, with neither replaced. Now, a decade and more into the 21st century, amidst the flaring testosterone of two wars and claims they justify the largest Pentagon budget in 2 decades, which does not include billions of dollars sent to Iraq never accounted for, the infrastructure of American society has declined further, and ever larger numbers of the nation's useful citizens sink into poverty. The malign neglect of the huge and growing underclass that lives abandoned and without hope in the nation's crumbling inner cities and impoverished rural areas will eventually ravage the society more than foreign terrorists can ever hope to achieve, and will certainly give rise to domestic terrorism if only for the purposes of survival. Millions of children live in poverty in the USA, most of them not white, which significantly lessens their chances of escaping destitution due to this country's prevailing racism. Dr. Charles Wilder, former director of Clatsop County Community Action Agency, once said that the war on poverty has become the war on the poor. The upward flow of the nation's wealth must be reversed, and the arid trickle-down become a flood if this trend is to be overhauled. The growing disparities in wealth and living standards undermine our society and threaten civil disorder on a massive scale, which presupposes a grim specter of the future worse than terrorism. Remedies for repairing our ravaged economy and reversing the intolerable social catastrophe it has precipitated are many, varied, complex, and depend on reapplying the nation's fundamental principles with fresh interpretations. The reestablishment of a union culture and radical reform of labor laws should be a primary goal, for the good reason that labor and production are at the heart of economic and political recovery. But across the broad tax reform that drastically reduces the military budget and eliminates the two-tiered tax system in which the privileged get most of the breaks and the rest of the citizenry pay the bulk of taxes, should be a serious consideration of returning power to the people. The tax system must be reformed in favor of taxpayers, first guaranteeing each an accounting of their money used by every level of government, and that basic returns for that money be automatic priorities such as food, shelter, and health medical care. After that, the basic infrastructures of a society that are the basis for taxation, such as transportation and energy requirements, public safety, emergency relief, and general livability for average citizens, must be maintained. The present system of required payment of taxes without any accountability for their use by government must be reversed, which is possible with the computerization of all public agencies. It will eventually be feasible in such a system that taxpayers have the legal power to determine where and how their tax monies are spent. Tax reformers usually attempt to allocate more tax monies to environmental and poverty programs, and many ideas are creative, such as energy and environmental taxes, as well as use and consumption taxes. Progressive taxation is the fairest redistribution of taxes from the wealthy to those most in need, but ultimately only a strong and determined tax revolt by a large number of ordinary citizens will bring about adequate and necessary reform. The debate over income taxes is long-standing and bitter. Groups both politically right and left wish to abolish the current tax system, which they claim is unconstitutional despite the superseding of original intent by the 16th Amendment. With the exception of the Civil War, Americans did not pay income taxes until 1913, and withholding taxes, and that was 100 years ago, and withholding taxes deducted from wages was a World War II innovation. The question of whether taxes should be collected under any circumstances might be answered that they be apportioned, raised, or lowered in consideration of the real needs of society, rather than the corporate welfare the tax system has become. The real power for change is revolt, which, if conducted by millions, could probably even subvert the extortion, as well as tyranny, of withholding paychecks before workers ever see them. It is quite probable the government would consider mass rebellion by taxpayers the worst conceivable form of terrorism and savagely respond with a campaign of extra-legal, police state-style counterterror, which is why any such revolt would have to occur in stages and obviously involve the courts, as well as simply refusing to file the forms, and must appeal to the most fundamental doctrines of the nation. Paradoxically, the theory of progressive taxation might as well be Marxist. Each pays according to his or her ability, according to their needs and obligations. The theory is that what is taken out of society should also be proportionately put back. The more you get, the more you are obliged to return. The reality is that those who reap the most give back the least, if they give back at all, and that which they keep is unproportionately made up by taxing those who reap the least. The greatest tax upon the society is the enormous cash flow of public money that disappears into the private fortunes of those who arrogantly loot the national treasury in full knowledge their avarice is unquestionably sanctioned. Perhaps as good an example of the inequity of the current tax system is that public money has been appropriated without public consent to bail out financial firms whose criminal greed has created the economic collapse that has thrown millions of ordinary Americans out of work and caused the foreclosure of millions of homes. The immediate response by the government during this, the worst financial disaster since the Great Depression, was to provide hundreds of billions of public taxes to prop up the guilty institutions while belatedly, one might even say reluctantly, providing considerably less economic aid to the rest of the country that has suffered the most and whose taxes have protected the affluence of those whose reckless greed triggered the disaster. Theodore Roosevelt had it right when he said, "The real enemy of anarchist capitalists are socialist working people." And that was The Tax Wars. And then I'd like to now go on to The Sprays of Spring, which I also wrote, and the disclaimer holds. A quote by Rachel Carson: "The chemical war is never won, and all life is caught in its crossfire." Sweet spring, buds, blooms, and blossoms, sounds of birds and crop dusters, skies shot with billowy clouds and mists of pesticides. The eternal war against insects and weeds is renewed. We are dusted, misted, sprayed, hosed, and powdered with some of the deadliest chemicals ever conceived to kill pickle worms, aphids, leafhoppers, spider mites, cabbage worms, spittle bugs, potato beetles, carpenter ants, Japanese beetles, corn earworms, grasshoppers, coddling moths, blister beetles, as well as unwanted plants and weeds. We're exposed to insecticides, miticides, acaricides, nematicides, fungicides, bactericides, avicides, herbicides, rodenticides, pesticides, molluscicides, and predicides, plus desiccants and defoliants. These pesticides kill by simply touching insects. They kill when swallowed or being taken into the blood of animals or the sap of plants. They kill through inhalation or by being otherwise absorbed. Selective pesticides are designed to kill only certain kinds of plants, insects, or animals. Non-selective pesticides kill most plants, insects, and animals. These chemicals are sprayed by aircraft, from tanks on trucks, from knapsack containers, hoses, and handheld sprayers. They are dusted, misted, or sprayed over farms, forests, and gardens, and also are used on school playgrounds, golf courses, the lawns of public buildings, and along roadsides. They drift in forms of dust and mist, or move with soil particles by erosion. They leach through the soil into lakes, rivers, and streams, and are carried as residues on crops and livestock, or evaporate and move with air currents. Of course, we are not only assaulted by pesticides from air, land, and water through inhalation or permeation. We eat and drink them also in fruits, vegetables, meats, and milk. 1 billion pounds of these poisons are applied annually within the United States, and it is virtually impossible to live anywhere in the country without being exposed. In many areas, saturated. Wildlife is contaminated. Food chains are affected. Habitat is destroyed, and human life is endangered. Pesticides are linked to cancer, nervous system damage, degenerative changes in liver and kidneys, fetal injury, miscarriages, birth defects, genetic mutations, and other serious diseases. Pesticides occur in mother's milk and in the tissues of unborn children. Exposure to these chemicals causes irreversible changes that alter genetic materials in cells permanently. Pesticide residues and their breakdown products are routinely found in blood and urine samples from both urban and rural residents nationwide. Pesticide residues capable of causing cancer and mutations show up in human sperm samples. A study by the National Academy of Sciences concluded that 28 pesticides known to cause cancer and found in foods might cause more than 1 million cancers over the next 70 years, and the Natural Resources Defense Council, a private environmental group, reports that children's exposure to pesticides and potential harm from these chemicals in food is 6 to 12 times greater than that of adults. Rachel Carson, who sounded the alarm about the dangers of pesticides in her 1962 book, Silent Spring, called these poisons biocides. There are two kinds of biocides, botanical or organic, and synthetic or man-made. Though the first are dangerous enough, powdered arsenic has been used for centuries and has a significant death toll, the synthetic chemicals are unsurpassed in their toxicity. Initial development of these chemicals was during World War II, following the discovery of DDT. Ironically, the growth of the synthetic pesticide industry started in the war years by testing these chemicals on insects as possible agents to kill human enemies. The government regulatory process is a failure as much in pesticide abuse as Pentagon contracts. The political and commercial copulative relationship between agencies and industry rules out any effectively honest regulation of pesticide use and abuse. In fact, government agencies rely on manufacturers' data about pesticide safety with the ingenuous claim the process saves taxpayers money. Other information about toxicity levels or research is either suppressed or often falsified. The standard used by both government and industry is a so-called safe level of toxicity, though it has been determined there is no safe level of exposure to anything that causes cancer or mutations, which is used short of outright banning of a substance and is generally assumed to not cause immediate harm. As these chemicals are new, when first labeled, there is no other method of determining long-range or cumulative effects than wait and see. Even when a chemical is harmful to test animals, industry and government officials say they cannot be sure they are harmful to humans. Labeling information is itself suspect, particularly claims that a pesticide is safe or that its ingredients are non-poisonous. Whenever a substance is banned or restricted, which is seldom, unrestricted use of stocks on hand are usually allowed to be sold and used while a number of equally toxic chemicals that are in the wait-and-see stage are put into use as replacements. Chemicals that are singled out as a result of harmful effects are rarely equated with the multiple effects of cumulative exposure to dozens of pesticides, often simultaneously. Not only has the ingenuous development of synthetic pesticides outrun the knowledge of their disastrous effects on living organisms, but residues from their manufacture accumulate in largely unregulated dumps where some break down into even deadlier compounds that seep into land, water, and air. Carol Van Strum of Five Forks, Oregon, in her 1983 book, A Bitter Fog, Herbicides and Human Rights, echoed a call by Rachel Carson for a constitutional amendment to protect citizens from environmental poisoning. To those who bear the risk, she wrote, exposure to poisons is a matter of life and death. Decisions about poisons which disrupt the basic mechanisms of life and the biological integrity of future generations raise profound moral questions. Society cannot afford to entrust such decisions to corporate or political entities that exempt themselves from the restraints of morality and ethics. And that was Carol Van Strom. Current law requires a person threatened with exposure to a toxic chemical to prove that irreparable harm will result, while the information for such proof is kept secret or not available because adequate research has not been done. Not to mention revisions of studies that are watered down to support the toxic chemical industry. Van Strom believes, quote, that a society insisting on its right of informed consent would quickly redirect pest control toward non-poisonous methods of integrated pest system of checks and balances toward non-poisonous methods of integrated pest management, unquote. Pest control, she also writes, would adopt nature's system of checks and balances essential to a true democracy. Rachel Carson said that the only reason the Bill of Rights contains no guarantees that a citizen shall be secure against lethal poisons distributed whether by private individuals or government officials is because our forefathers, despite their considerable wisdom and foresight, could conceive of no such problem. An informed consent amendment has already provided a constitutional basis by the Ninth Amendment, which states that in addition to the specific rights enumerated in the Constitution, there are, quote, others retained by the people, unquote. History, however, has shown that specific rights must necessarily be specified if they are to be upheld. Nothing could be more specific than two questions posed by Van Strom. Do I or do I not have the right to know the effects of the stuff you intend to expose me to? Do you or do you not have to get my permission before exposing me to it? A constitutional amendment would not be an instant or complete solution to the problems of pesticides, and government and industry will spend millions of dollars fighting it. But as Van Strom says, in opposing informed consent, government and industry would have to admit that toxic exposure does occur and that people have no right either to know about it or stop it. They would have to convince the public that ignorance and helplessness are preferable to knowledge and control. In the meantime, the insects we attempt to eradicate continue to build resistance to pesticides, which provokes development of ever more toxic chemicals. For humans to build resistance will take hundreds of generations at roughly 3 generations a century. New insect generations occur in a matter of days or weeks. The chemical control of plants and insects turns out to be a greater menace to ourselves than to its targets. Future historians may well be amazed by our own distorted sense of proportion, Rachel Carson wrote in Silent Spring. How could intelligent beings seek to control an unwanted species by a method that contaminated the entire environment and brought the threat of disease and death even to their own kind? And I wrote that with gratitude to Rachel Carson and Carol Van Strom, also to Mary Sellen and Dee Myatel of Ocean, and Helen Patty Hill, whose articles on pesticides in previous issues of the North Coast Times-Eagle provided the essential research for this article, which I call The Sprays of Spring. And I rushed through it because this half hour, it's almost like a cell, a jail cell. And even though I read them earlier to try to pace myself or whatever you might call it, speed up or slow down, never works right. Time still doesn't come out on the money. But at any rate, these two poisonous issues, taxes and pesticides, and the only way in which these things are going to change, and if nothing else, the commonality of both these articles, aside from their dangers, is also the fact it's going to take public opinion and public motivation and finally public power to overturn, if indeed we ever hope for them to overturn. Well, this has been Michael McCusker. I believe I might be with you next Thursday, which will be the day after KMUN's 30th birthday and the day before Alexia Lee's 20th birthday. I suppose I'll be back if I don't fall into the river or the sky doesn't fall on me, or if one of those pesky drones doesn't spot me on the street and incinerate me in my shoes.